Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 402. And last time we were with the subject of going to war, finding a woman, and marrying a woman. In other words, God gave Israel instructions how to behave when they go to war. And mind you, when you study this issue here, it's a very profound concept here, you know, subject. There is an awful lot that you can say about it. For the simple reason is, every time people went to war, soldiers went to war, what was on their mind? Not only killing the enemy, destroying them, you see, but robbing them. And if they saw women there, they raped them, they plundered, they burned, they destroyed, you see. They were not people of God. But Israel was to be a special nation, that their emotions, their feelings, their actions were to be bridled, governed by the law of God. And so when they go to war, and God says, knowing human nature, knowing the way, you know, men function, you go to war, you're going to see a woman, you see. If you look at all the men all around you and all the other nations, and if you are not obedient as they should be, what is it that comes to your mind when you see a beautiful woman? And so he said, you better not do it. In other words, that's not the time for raping a woman. If you want a woman, if you like her, you're a man of God. You're a servant of God. You're obedient to the law of God. You're a member of the royal priesthood. You don't behave like that. You're going to be the light of the world. And so you're going to show the world how the people of God fight when they go to war. You see? You see a woman, you want to marry her, not rape her, not abuse her. And what happens to the nations when they hear about people who behave in that manner, which is totally different than they all do? As Moses told them earlier, when the whole world, you know, sees what kind of people you are, what kind of law that you have, they will come and say, what a wonderful nation it is, what a great nation it is that has such laws. They're going to be very much impressed with it. You see, and they would want to be like you. You know, the decent among them, obviously, not the rebel rousers, not the evil doers among them. But many would desire to be that way. And so when women fell into in battle, you see, into the hands of an Israelite soldier, they would know they're not going to be treated like their own soldiers treat others. They would be treated with respect and honor. She's not going to be raped, you see. She may be taken as a servant, as a maid. And if she's beautiful, she knows full well somebody's going to marry her and take care of her. And so you think about all these matters. God is thinking about everything here. And so when he studied this law of war, you have to look at it from that point of view also. What is it that God desires for his people to be? Be you holy, for I am holy. And you're not holy when you go and rape. That's exactly what all the armed forces, unfortunately, have been doing. The crusaders, when they went, supposedly in the name of Christ, to deliver Jerusalem, liberate, you know, the Holy Land, what have they done along the way? Especially among the Jewish towns. They raped all the women, and they've done it to all other women that they could, and oftentimes even their own women. Now, in other words, women that were called supposedly Christians, you see, Christian communities just didn't like them, especially if they were newly converted, or, you know, they were of different nations. But they were, you know, nevertheless, like in the Middle East, they were so-called Christians. They raped them too. Were they holy people? Were they people of God? Were they really fighting for God? Obviously not. They were, you know, children of the devil. And that's basically what the most overwhelming majority of the so-called armies of Christian Europe. That's the way they behaved. That's what they've done to women. God says, you don't behave like that. You don't do this kind of things. You see? A lot of hypocrites out there. A lot of bigots and evildoers, and yet they have the audacity to call themselves Christians, and they would go to church after that and give thanks and glory and honor to and sing to God, you know, for the victory and things like that, and they forgot about all the abominable things that they have committed along the way, and God was not there listening to them. He didn't take that praise. He was not interested in that praise. He was not interested, you know, in the praise of sinners and the fools and the hypocrites and the evildoers. And that's what God is saying here. You see a woman, you like her, you fancy her, don't think about raping her. That's contrary to the law. You see? No fornication among the people of God. And so that leaves an awesome impression on the minds and the hearts of people. And so it shall be in the future when it says in Zechariah 14, and Judah shall fight also, you see, against the enemies of God, the enemies of Israel. And then later on you read about Joseph and Judah plundering the whole nation. Well, plundering, you know, not in the wrong sense, but conquering the whole land, just like they were supposed to when they came into the land of Canaan. And that's what God is going to make Israel do. People today call themselves Americans and British and French and all that, who are despising Israel, their brother, you know, Judah. And they are down on them all the time. They want them to give back and give back and give back to people to whom it does not belong. God is going to make these very people, the remnant of them, go to battle and war and destroy all those people and wipe them out and throw them out, you see. And most of them are going to be decimated, the Palestinians and the Lebanese people, you see, and a lot of the people of Syria. And all those territories all the way to the Euphrates belong to the people of Israel. And obviously those people are not going to give it up peacefully. And so war is going to be there. And when the armies of Israel march and God is in front of them, that's Jesus Christ, is going to lead the battle. People don't realize that. Don't think about it. Read it in Isaiah 11. They're not going to behave like the Arabs recently, before that is, had done to the people of Judah and Israel. Especially to the people of Judah, since the whole nation is there. You see, where that too is described. And you can read it in the book of Joel. And in Joel chapter 3, you can read verse 1, "For behold, in those days and at that time, when I bring back the captivities of Judah and Jerusalem," you see, speaking about this day, our day, and that happened already 50 years ago, God brought back the captivity of Judah and Jerusalem. He's the one that did it. They were in captivity in Europe, you see, and captive to the Middle Eastern Arabs too. I happened to be one of them. And we had riots and pogroms and many, you know, people got killed. I had several people, members of my own family, including my mother and baby brothers and older brother, were murdered, you know, with vicious hands of Arabs. Why? Because they were Jews, that's all. And this is the captivity he's talking about. He brought the people of Judah back to their land. And then verse 2, he says, "I will also gather all the nations." So immediately after that, and that's basically what started happening from that time. First the Arab nations, and then ultimately, as Arafat tries very hard, he's trying to bring down the United Nations, the NATO allies, you know, to force Israel to give him his land. And so this is going to happen. But God is going to be behind it also. "I will also gather all the nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat, and I will enter into judgment with them there on account of my people, my heritage, Israel." This is Jesus Christ speaking. Who is the heritage of Jesus Christ? Not the so-called the church. You see? The Gentile religion. His people. That's his wife. That's his people. And all the house of Israel also that he's going to bring back to their land. "That's my heritage," he said, "whom they have scattered among the nations," which they've done in the past, including the people of Israel. You see, not only Judah, but Judah and Israel, so he's talking about all of Israel. "And they have also divided up my land," which they've done. You know, even the British were involved in that, the partition plan, and the United Nations was involved in that, and they had no business doing it. You see, and the people of Israel, the American people, the Northwestern Europe, they were all involved in the division of the land of God, being ignorant of their own heritage, not even knowing their identity. So they have also divided up my land. That's an abomination in the sight of God, and he's going to hold them responsible for it and bring them to judgment. We've done that. Because a lot of these people supposedly are Christians, and they should know their Bibles and what God says about that land. They don't believe it. And they have the audacity in holding the Bible, being sworn by the Bible, and go to church. And then they despise Jesus Christ and His Word. There's going to be an awful lot of judgment on many people. God is going to begin with His own house. You know, as Peter said, judgment begins at the house of God. And he's not speaking about the so-called the church. He's speaking about the house of God, and that's Israel. And some of them were spiritual, and most of them are not. And Peter is writing his letter to the people of Israel, not to the Gentile world. He's a minister, you know, he was a minister to the circumcision, not to the uncircumcision. And so he says, they have also divided up my land, they have cast lots for my people, and they have given a boy as a payment for harlot. What is he talking about? Sodomy, abusing, you see, his people sexually, and sold a girl for wine that they may drink. You see? So God says, this is what you have done. You haven't behaved as a holy people according to laws of righteousness. You claim to be Muslims or Christians or whatever. Now look what you do to my people. Nowhere in the Quran or in the so-called Christian Bible, which is not the New Testament, do you find any teachings about raping, you know, women or using men, you know, or boys, young people, for that purpose. And yet they do it. They couldn't care less, and yet they have the audacity of calling themselves either the Muslims or the faithful. You see, well, Muhammad never taught that, but contrary to that. And then others call themselves Christians, and they're anything but that. See, these are all children of darkness, and unfortunately, many of them are children of Israel, don't even know it. And so, this is what you have done. But in specific, he's talking about the very people who were more involved in it. In other words, the neighborhood bullies, you know, the enemies of God and the enemies of Israel. And so he's speaking about then, verse 4, indeed, what have I to do with you? That is, what have you to do with me, O Tyre and Sidon? And all the coasts of Philistia, the Gaza Strip, all the Arabs there, you see, the Hezbollah in Lebanon and all the other Lebanese there, that's an Israelite territory and they don't realize it. It's all going to be taken away from them and all of them are going to be put to death. They don't realize that the death penalty hangs over their head and God himself is going to execute it through his people Israel. And that's where the story of Joseph and Judah, all of Israel, in chapter 11 of Isaiah, and in Obadiah also, this is what you read about it. God is going to send his armies, the remnant of his people Israel, and is going to decimate all these people. And so he says, will you retaliate against me? That's in essence what they are doing. They're going to take it as vengeance against his own people, you see. And they'll think, you know, everything is okay. You can do anything with them, you know. We're taking vengeance for all that they've done to us. But God takes it, he personally. Will you retaliate against me? Swiftly and speedily, I will return your retaliation upon your own head. Why? Because you've taken my silver and my gold. You know, everything that you've taken from that land, it belongs to me. You see? And he said, you've taken all those things and carried them into your temples. Well, today they have mosques and others have churches because in Lebanon you have both Muslims and then you have so-called Christians. And the people of Judah and the people of Jerusalem you have sold to the Greeks. And Greece has always been anti-Jewish. To this very day it is. There's an awful lot of anti-Semitism there in Greece. And a lot of Greek people in Jerusalem, there is a Greek quarter. And to begin with, many of the Philistines, you see, this is where they came from, the real Philistines, they came from the Greek islands. And Lebanon, you find a lot of Greek people from the days of Alexander the Great, you see. A lot of Greeks all around there. And so this is what he's talking here. And you have sold, you know, them to the Greeks that you may remove them far from your border. Well, in essence, he says, and I'm going to repay you for that. Behold, verse 7, I will raise them out of the place to which you have sold them and will return your retaliation upon your own head. You know, tooth for tooth, eye for eye. God is not going to let them get away with it. He said, I will sell your sons and your daughters into the hand of the people of Judah, so slavery is going to be there. And they will sell them to the Sabaeans, to a people afar off, for the Lord has spoken. And so God is talking about the time when he's going to repay all his evil neighbors, as he calls them somewhere else in Jeremiah, of his. And yet at the same time, when Judah and when Israel goes to war, how are they going to treat the prisoners? How are they going to treat the women among them? Still the same way, in accordance with the law of Moses. You can't rape women. You want a woman, you can have her for two reasons. Either for a slave, servant, maid, nanny, things like that. You don't abuse her. You see, there are laws, you know, rights of employees, protection, things like that. Those things are in the law of Moses. They were not invented recently. That's the reason why the Jews are extremely involved in that, you know, in the forefront of human rights. You see, labor rights, these rights, those kind of rights. That's because of their heritage. You know, because of the law of Moses, all those things that they've carried with them all this time, because they've been abused themselves all this time, they know how it feels to be abused. And so, these people are going to be taken as slaves, but the people of God are going to treat them nice and well. You see, they're not going to abuse them. If they like their women, they're going to marry them. If they don't like them, they're going to use them as nannies and servants, you know, and basically, for that reason. And those people in the process are going to learn the ways of God, and they are going to find out how different these people are, you know, that is, when they obey the law of God, and they are holy people, a royal priesthood. That's the wife of God. That's the church of God. And yet, look at the whore. That's what God calls a Gentile church, the whore, you see, and the harlots that came from her, how they in turn treated others when they rose to power, how they abused other people, how they went to war, both Catholics and Protestants, against each other and against others and against the Jewish people and against, you know, those who were not of the same religion, how they abused them, raped their women, you know, like in the, during the Crusades and later on. And to this very day, there is a lot of animosity and hatred and bigotry in their hearts against people who are not like them. You see, that's what God is saying here. There are laws of war. There are laws of behavior. Just because you go to war doesn't mean you forget, you know, your law and you forget who you are and leave it all behind. You don't behave like that. And that's what God is teaching His people. So this is the law of God. That's what God said. He's saying it to all the armies on the face of the earth. Unless you return to the law of Moses, which obviously He didn't give it to them to begin with, but He gave it to mankind in the Garden of Eden and all the righteous men before that. That's why you find a measure of morality in every given religion on the face of the earth, and rules of conduct and code of behavior. This is where they got it from. And that's the law that God gave Moses, plus the other things that He added here. But many of these laws you can find in the code of Hammurabi. Why? Because it came from Shem, that was at the time still there, alive, and his descendants. And it came from Noah, and it came from all the righteous men, and, you know, originally from the Garden of Eden. That's the same book, the same law, the same God. There is no change there. There is no difference. No new religion, no new God, no new theology. And this is Jesus Christ speaking here. That's why He's saying, you know, unless you return to My law, the law that I gave to Moses, you'll all be dead. God is not interested in a bunch of demons hanging around here and claiming to be His servants. And so, this is what He's saying here. Again, let's go back to Deuteronomy 21. Let's begin from verse 10. When you go forth to battle against your enemies, and they are not local, native enemies, and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands, and He's not going to do it if you are wicked, and they are righteous, more than righteous than you are, but because you're a holy people, so you're going to behave like a holy people. So He says, you know, when you carry away captive, because that's the end result of war, you know, you don't necessarily kill all of them, because many, you know, what do you do with those who give up? Well, you don't kill them, you take them as captive. That's how you get your labor force, your servants. And then you treat them nice. And you see among the captives a woman of goodly form, obviously, some of them are going to be good, you know, good looking, and you have desire unto her. It's okay with God. And would take her to you to wife. God is taking it for granted. That's the reason why you want to desire a woman. In other words, you have no business desiring any woman unless you're going to marry her. You see? That's reserved only for the husband to desire a woman and not for others. Others should desire their own woman, their own wife. So you can see a lot of instructions there already taken for granted because of all the law that He already given them and told them what they should do or they should not do, what attitude to have, what attitude not to have. They cannot fornicate, they cannot covet, they cannot commit adultery, they cannot rape, they cannot do any all those things. So obviously the only reason why you want a woman is because you want to marry her. Nothing else is accepted or even suggested here. And then you shall bring her home to your house, and she shall shave her head and pare her nails, In doing so, she's removing her old ways, you know, idolatrous ways, whatever it may be, you know, cutting off, you know, sort of, you know, burning the bridges of the past, of her heritage, and now she's going to be a part of the Commonwealth of Israel. Of course, it's not by choice, her own choice. But then, since they were enemies, they have no choice anyway when they lose the battle. And that's the way it goes. But now God says, now that she becomes a part of your property, a part of your household, you're going to treat her like any other daughter in Israel. You're going to treat her as a son of God treats a woman. Not an enemy, not a vicious enemy, not an evil, raping enemy. And so he said, this is what she's going to do. She's going to put off her raiment of captivity. And what does it mean, the raiment of captivity? Whatever she wore before that, and we mentioned earlier, it was a custom at the time to take the women into the forefront there, oftentimes dress them up nice, entice the enemy, things like that. Nothing have done it in every case, but that was a custom of the nations. And so she's going to remain in your house and bewail her father and her mother a full month. If you don't let her go through this process of adjusting, of being civil toward her and decent and caring for her emotions and feelings, what kind of a wife is going to be to you, you see, if you abuse her and mistreat her? So God is thinking about all those matters, and he's educating his own people to think properly, to think rightly, to think in a holy manner, to think in a godly manner, and so to treat every human being who is ultimately a son of God or a daughter of God to begin with, not an enemy. You see, that's something that comes down the road. So when you come to the bottom line, you always remember every single person on the face of the earth is a child of God, and so you should treat them. And that's the law of God, the way of God, the nature of God, the path of God. And when people say this law is done away with, obviously you're dealing with ignoramuses, blind people, deceived people, you see, and certainly not people of God. And so he says, this is what you do, you know, be merciful to her, compassionate, considerate of her feelings and emotions. Just because she's an enemy doesn't mean she's not a woman anymore. She's not an animal, you see. And so this is what she does. And he said, after that, you can go in unto her. Now, what does this terminology, as we mentioned earlier, last time? Be'alta, in Hebrew, that's what it means, be'alta, going unto her, you become her Baal. And Baal, as we mentioned earlier, on other occasions, Baal was not just, you know, that god that people worshipped, but Baal means a master, owner, lord, you see? So you're going to be her lord, her master. And the very act of taking a woman sexually, you see, was also used to become a master as a sexual terminology. So when a woman is taken, you know, by men, you see, sexually, that terminology is used. And when a man or a woman take a possession, land or jewelry or whatever it may be, they use the same terminology also. Only then there is no sexual connotation. And so this is what it says here, Be'alta, and go in unto her. And that's literally you go in unto her and you have sex with her, and that's how she becomes your wife. Yeah, there is no priest involved there. There is no rabbi. All that is a much later invention. And yet people like to pretend in their ignorance and blindness because they don't know any better. They write all those ceremonies and they have the audacity to say something God never said, never told them. They can never prove it in the Bible, never see it there. They're saying there by the authority invested in me by the court of heaven, I now pronounce you husband and wife. And then they go back and say, oh, no, there is a law there that says, you know, that we are in the business of binding and loosing. That's not what God is talking about. Nowhere would you see this thing ever mentioned in the Bible when it comes to marriage. That's only between the parents. That's between the individuals to arrange that. That's a private matter. The priesthood doesn't belong there. And also, likewise, for burial, it's up, you know, up to the family to bury their dead. The priest doesn't belong there. That's later on when people began to take over, becoming, you know, lords over the heritage of God. They began to do those things. And they intruded into every area of life, just like government had done. You see? The same spirit, the same mind. Abuse of power. Wanting total control over the lives of people, and God never gave them that total control. You see? That's the problem. Then, you know, people get used to it. They take it for granted, just like we take, you know, for granted everything government does. And to begin with, we realize they have no business being in many areas that they are. And yet they get into every tiny little detail of your private life, and that's a horrible abuse, and they're going to stand for in judgment for that. And all the legislators who produce all those laws are going to be, you know, standing in judgment for that, and they will have to answer for it. And whatever the penalty God is going to give them, we're going to find out in the future. But God abhors people who exercise dominion and authority over the private lives of His own people. Now, teach them the law of God, teach them the ways of God, that's one thing. You know, maintain law and order, have laws of law and order, things like that, you see, that's one thing. But to enter into their private life and to begin to regulate their own life in every tiny little detail, that's an abomination. That's a demonic mind that wants to do it. Mind control, body control. You see, you treat them as abject property, abject slaves, nobodies. And that's in essence what happens. So God says, no, that's the way it is. And that's the way it's been always in Israel. You wanted a woman, you know, you made an arrangement between the parents, and then you had a celebration, a party, you had a wedding party, but you don't have a priest officiating, you don't have a rabbi officiating. That's none of their business. And basically what you do, just, you know, you sign a document, you know, where the husband signs the document that he's going to take care of his wife. And he gives it to the wife in a certain amount of possessions, whatever it may be. And just in case, you know, she's rejected for any reason, she'll have something, you know, to go with instead of being destitute, because that's in essence what happened in those days, unless you can go back to your own family. And if you couldn't, you were destitute. And that's the reason why a lot of women became harlots, because they ended up not being taken care of by anybody. And so what else could they do, you know, in order to survive, especially if they had children? And that's unfortunate. That's an abomination in the sight of God. You know, these are some of the iniquities of Israel, and they are to this very day. And so it says you're just going unto her. That's how marriage occurs. You're going unto her. And if you see movies about ancient times, you know, in Ireland or Scotland or Europe, you see basically that. There is a party, you know, and then the men and women, they go up upstairs, something like that, and they have sex, and that's it. Marriage took place. No priesthood involved. That came later. And so this is what he says here. You're going unto her, she'll become your wife. That's how it happens. Which is ironic, because a lot of people today, you know, they think they can live together and have sex and have children and they're not married. There is no such a thing. If you went in unto her and you're living with her, you see, you're married in the sight of God. That's bound. You're bound to each other. You cannot fornicate at that point. You see, you cannot commit adultery. And because of ignorance, people think, well, you know, I was not married by a rabbi or minister, therefore, you know, I'm not really married. There's no such a thing in the sight of God. That's a human man-made law. And God says, in vain do you worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. And the marriage ceremony and the burial ceremony, these are all the doctrines of men. They have nothing to do with God. You see, those are cultural things, you know, societal things. Those are, you know, human decisions. God didn't come up with these kind of things, and yet, you know, we take it for granted like anything else, and we think, well, that's the only way it occurs. And so we're all confused about all those people that are living together, and that's what they say, you know, they shack up together, or live together, or cohabit, or whatever it may be. All of them are married in the sight of God, whether they like it or not, whether they believe it or not, or understand it or not. It's neither here nor there. A man makes a commitment to a woman to live together with her and have sex with her, he's married. That's what Paul was trying to tell the Corinthians. Don't you know that when a man goes to a woman, they become one flesh? How did Adam and Eve become one flesh? He went and had sex with her. Who was the rabbi? Who was the priest performing the ceremony there? None. You see, God created the woman, gave her to Adam. He went in unto her. She became his wife. You see, well, in those days, you know, there were just two of them. Obviously, they didn't have ceremony and didn't invite guests. And, you know, there were no guests to invite, nobody around. You see? And that's how it began. Now, a lot of people, they do not go to the beginning to find out how things are, and they just take it for granted the way they are at the moment, and they think, well, that's it. And so they worship God in vain. And that's why a lot of people are idol worshippers or into false religions or into all kind of false doctrines, because they never investigate their own religion, where it came from. You see? And so they just go their own merry way, thinking, well, that's the way it is, and it's all from God, and it's not. And anybody who sins there, you know, and says, by the authority invested in me by the court of heaven, and I pronounce your husband and wife, in essence, he's lying. He doesn't know it, you know, he's sincere. You see? And doesn't realize it, what he's doing. He thinks, well, that's the doctrine of my church, and that's in the Bible, and it's not. God is the one that binds, not man. If God doesn't bind it, man can bind all he wants. Nothing is going to happen. And God is the one that looses, not man. And so when people were given the authority, be the priesthood later on, as Christ told his own people, the disciples, you can do it too, because obviously you have to govern the body of believers, you know, and talk to them about the binding and loosing. It's based on the law of God that he already gave, not based on their own opinion. And when people don't understand that, then they invent their own doctrines and they worship God in vain. And so this is one thing here. So, he went into her, she became his wife. They're bound. That's what God is saying here. You don't play games. You see? Verse 14. And it shall be, if you have no delight in her, because that happens too, then you shall let her go whether she will. Well, you realize she's not of the same culture, the same background of bringing in all that. You don't like her cooking. You don't like this and that and the other thing. You know, and, you change your mind. What do you do then? Just kick her out? Of course not. God is the creator of that woman too, not only of you. So you're going to treat her, you know, just like a child of God as you are. Love your friend as yourself. She's your friend now. You see, that's why. So God says, I'm going to govern on what you're going to do at this point too. So first we heard about the binding, and now we're going to read about the loosing. And God governs both, not man. Not the priesthood, not the rabbis, not the clergy. And it shall be, if you have no delight in her, then you shall let her go wherever she wills. You know, if she wants to go home to the old country, she can go there. If she wants just to stick around, because, you know, by now she likes the people, maybe she has children, whatever, and all kind of things like that. And, you know, maybe other members of the family may like her and want to keep her there and take care of her. Or maybe another man, you know, wants to marry her. You see, whatever. Let her go wherever she wants. And you shall not sell her at all for money. She's not a property. She's your wife. You see, you can't treat her like that just because she was a slave. And so that's what he's saying here. You don't do it. You shall not deal with her as a slave because she became your wife, you see. And when she became your wife, you went in unto her, you had sex with her. And so that's what God is saying here. Because you have humbled her. And what does humble? You know, this is an idiom in Hebrew, you see, which means, the word in Hebrew, inita means impoverished her and also humbled. You know, the two are, two connotations are there in this word. To make somebody poor, that's to humiliate a person of his dignity and respect, you rob it from him. Or when you take somebody's virginity away from her, you see, you rob her of her virginity in that sense, and you cannot do it, he said. You have humbled her, you see. You have stripped her, you know, of her virginity. You cannot not treat her, you know, as a slave, as a merchandise. So God never allowed this second-rate citizen among women that people developed in their minds and hearts. This is not from God, you see. Not for your wife, and certainly, you see, well, actually, certainly not for your wife. And even so, the person could have been a slave before that. You cannot do it to them either. It doesn't make any difference who that person is. You can do it. Always treat a human being with love and affection and mercy and compassion and respect. And if you lost your love toward that person, the respect should remain. Now, that's a major problem among all people when they have relationships. It does not begin with respect. It begins with supposed love. Well, what happens when love is gone? They begin to hate one another and treat each other as enemies. But what happens if they've established a relationship first of respect, of consideration, of caring for the feelings of others, even when you don't love them anymore, you know, you call it, you know, fall in love or fall out of love, the respect should remain, the consideration, the nobility of behavior, of conduct, remembering, okay, I don't love her anymore, she doesn't love me anymore, but, you know, we're still human beings. We should love our neighbors ourselves. I want to be treated, you know, with respect. I should treat her with respect. But people don't function like that. No, not even among the people of God. A lot of them don't. That's why we have an awful lot of problems even among ourselves. Learn to respect and honor people. And then, whether you have emotions or feeling and feelings of love or not, you know, whether you had them or now you don't have them, it's neither here nor there. The honor and the respect and the consideration, you see, should remain forever. And in that, you fulfill the royal law. You see, even, you know, if you do not have the emotions of love anymore. Verse 15, now God goes to another law. If a man have two wives, and people say, now, wait a minute, you know, isn't bigamy wrong, you know, against the law of God? As I say, you know, some people in their ignorance and blindness said about Father Abraham, you know, he was committing bigamy because he had another wife. Well, that's because of the Protestant background, the Christian background, not godly background. They had no godly background. The thing they did, you see, they lived by the doctrines of their own church, the perverted doctrines of their own church, and concepts and ideas. And so they look at this matter here, and that's how they think about it. God didn't say, now wait a minute, hey, begin with, you're not supposed to have two wives. No, he just took it for granted if a man has two wives. Why? Because in Sinai, God didn't see it fit to forbid, you know, the multiple marriages. He doesn't want people to have too many they cannot take care of, you see. But he didn't say, you know, no more two wives. He just said no more two sisters, like, you know, in the case of Jacob who married two sisters. No more, you know, certain things. But two wives, why would people have two wives? Well, when people are farmers, they need a lot of workers, they've got a field, they've got to work in the land. A woman is pregnant, well, he's out of luck. Now he has to do all the work all by himself. He can't do it. You see, so I have to look about the logistic of the matter, you know, the pragmatic situation they had to deal with. And the reality of life at the time, you know, things were different. So they needed more than one wife. Not necessarily because they were, you know, just lusty, you know, for women and things like that. It was a necessity. So God did not deny that necessity. Now, had they lived in an ideal life, like in the Garden of Eden, in the beginning as it was so, there would be no need for more than one wife. But Israel, in spite of all the blessings that God gave them, was no Garden of Eden. By the sweat of their brow, they had to work, as he told Adam, and under the circumstances, one woman was not good enough. They needed more employees, and the only employees they had, generally speaking, are their own children. The more children you had, the better you did. And you don't necessarily want to have a woman pregnant all the time to have many children, because that's not good for her either. So you see how God was thinking about the whole situation there? And when we begin to think about it from that point of view, from God's point of view, you know, we alter our thinking process. Now, what about today? Some people would say, why can't I do it? Well, you do not live in that society anymore. You're not a farmer, generally speaking. You're living a totally different life, you see. And people degenerated, and things are not as they used to be in the old days. How is it going to be in the future? Since God is going to abundantly bless the land, there would be no need for two wives. You see? And so things are going to be different. So you have to think about this point here from an administrative point of view. That was a part of the administration that God instituted at that time. You want to have two wives, it's okay. Just behave, you know, treat them nice. And that's what he's saying here. And, you know, oftentimes we should check our attitudes and thoughts and concepts and feelings, you know, be it, you know, if we are men or women. Where did they come from? What are they based on? You see? Are they based on the abuse that we have witnessed all around us? Are they based on our upbringing and culture, or, you know, the customs of the society? Or are they based on the law of God? When you come to this point here, you cannot condemn God for saying it. You cannot condemn the people who have done it. You cannot accuse them of bigamy. There is no such a thing in the Bible. You see? And not even polygamy. You see? Because the polygamy has, a derogatory connotation today. You know, you say, well, that guy is a polygamist, you know, put down. Or bigamist. It's not a biblical law. Simple as that. Does it mean that it's good? No, it's not good. It's better for a man to have... it's better for a man to have only one wife. As Christ put it, you know, in the beginning it was not so. God, you know, created Adam, then created Eve, and that was it. That's the way it was in the beginning. But we're not talking about ideal life, utopian life. And when you don't have utopian life, you function under the circumstances. And this was a part of them. So let's understand it from this point of view. And where everything is well and nice and taken care of, and Utopia is here, and all are abiding by the law of God, and there is abundance of blessing, and the whole earth is blessed and not cursed anymore. And again, we're going to go back to the beginning. One man, one woman. So let's think about it from that point of view. Even God Himself, you know, had to live under a circumstance where you read in Ezekiel 23. What happened to the nation of Israel that was his wife? It was divided into two. You see? In other words, the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah were totally separated. And yet God was dealing with both of them. So now God is not, in Ezekiel 23, you read how God talks about them, about Samaria and about Judah, and he said, but then those were two women, and both of them were his. Does it mean he had two wives? Under the circumstances, he did. Israel was one nation, a nation is a wife. Judah was a nation is a wife. He had two wives. And they were two sisters. Think about it. Why? Circumstances created that necessity. But in the beginning it wasn't so. In the beginning the two were one. You see? And in the future he's going to make the two of them again one. So again he's going to have only one wife. But there was a circumstance where after the division he ended up with two wives. Two women. You know, for a period of time until Israel was sent into idolatry and then only one was left behind, Judah. So, let's learn to think like God and forget about our own, you know, feelings and emotions of the moment. And so, this is what he's saying here. This is the circumstance of the time. If a man has two wives, the one beloved and the other hated, and it happens, and they have borne him children, both the beloved and the hated, and if the firstborn son be Heres, or the hated one that was hated, then it shall be in the day that he causes his sons to inherit that which he has, that he may not make the son of the beloved the firstborn before the son of the hated. You see, there was that case before that, and God is addressing also that issue indirectly of what happened with Jacob. He had two wives. He really wanted Rachel. He didn't want Leah. He got stuck with her, and that's not his fault. And yet we see him and his behavior there. He was preferring Rachel. He loved her, and he didn't like Leah. And obviously Leah felt pretty bad about it, and God gave her the children first and not to Rachel. It took quite a while before Rachel got any. And she developed an attitude there because of that. But in another case, God makes it very plain that, well, they have two women. One of them might be hated. It's neither here nor there. And the law is the law. Hers is the firstborn. He gets the property of the firstborn, the inheritance of the firstborn. And so he says in verse 17, but he shall acknowledge the firstborn, the son of the hated, by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the firstfruits of his strength. The right of the firstborn is his. What does the firstborn get? A lot of people, you know, having very little understanding as they should about the inheritance that God gave Joseph, you see, through Jacob. And the thing, well, Joseph received the birthright, and the birthright means he gets 90% and 10% left over, you know, for the others, or something like that. That's not what the, you know, firstborn means, and that's not what the birthright means. Even though what he got was far greater than all the others, but when he put all the others and all that they have to, put together, and then on top of that, the fact that all of them, you see, to one degree or the other, reside with the people of Joseph. Not in Britain as much, but even in Britain, you know, you find their wealth, and Scotland and Ireland, you know, they are not Ephraim. You see, they are not the people of Joseph, and yet they reside with them and share the same blessings, you see. But especially in the United States, the people of Manasseh, of course, some people think that the other way around, whichever is the case. But in this land, you find every single tribe of Israel represented very heavily and oftentimes much more than in their own country. For example, the Scottish people, they're all Jews, you know, from the line of Zerah. The few among them that are wise, you know, historically minded, they know that, they know where they came from. And as I mentioned earlier, but His Royal Highness Prince Michael of Albany, the heir to the throne of Scotland, if there is such a thing, that is, if the British would allow it, obviously, but it's still in existence, whether they like it or not, the British, which, you know, they oftentimes try to make people believe it does not even exist, there's nobody there. You know, they've been hiding it historically from the people. But that family continued, and they're still there. And it makes it very plain that the people of Scotland are Jews, you see. And the royalty is linked to the house of David. You see, their king married, at a certain point, married another daughter of Zedekiah, the last king of Judah. And he makes it very plain. There are about 42 million Scotsmen all around the world. They call it, you know, the Scottish Kingdom. And most of them are in the United States. Now, there aren't that many in Scotland itself. You see? And, you know, Irish people, an awful lot of them here. And Danish people and other nations of Israel. You know, a lot of French people here and so forth. In Canada and the United States. So, when you look at it from that point of view, you begin to realize what the birthright was all about that Joseph received. You see? So people are misunderstanding when they see all the statements about all the great blessings that he received and think it was only for himself. Well, as Joseph was in Egypt, all the sons of Israel came and sojourned with him and they shared the same blessings that he had. So you have to understand from that point of view, otherwise you don't get it properly. And here it is, the law of the firstborn, double portion. What does it mean, double portion? Well, we're going to discuss that next time. Again, this is Mordecai Joseph. Greetings to all of God's people. Until the next lesson.